Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to The Obscure Wait, today's episode of Resounding Echoes. Resounding Echoes. I am going to start today with a first for this program, in that I find myself in the thus far unprecedented position of being able to play an excerpt from a brand spanking new recording, no less. But let's listen to a little before I say any more. That was an excerpt from the First Symphony by the precocious Kurt Weill, who was even younger than the 20th century itself when he wrote it. It was played there by the Konzerthaus Orchester Berlin, conducted by Johanna Malwitz. It has just been released on Deutsche Grammophon, and as we have come to expect, the cover epitomizes DG's and many other record labels' minimalist aesthetic. By that I mean it showcases their typical employment of minimal effort, minimal imagination, minimal taste, and minimal regard for customers who buy CDs because they consider them beautiful objects, especially when their visual appearance is in harmony with their musical content. Things as much to look at as to listen to. In saying this, I mean absolutely no disrespect to the excellent conductor who appears on this particular cover. It is a general thinking or lack of behind these images that I can't abide, and not in any way the actual physical appearance of the musicians, who are, I suspect, contractually obliged to be marketed in this way. So maybe buy the download instead and do yourselves and the environment a favour. Last week's programme was devoted to Die Jakobsleiter by Arnold Schönberg. I said then that in those years Schönberg was developing his method of composing with 12 independent notes. In this context, there is another composer who is often mentioned. Indeed, many see him as anticipating Schönberg's ideas in this sphere. His name is Josef Matthias Hauer. There is no need to go looking for any conspiracy theories or evidence of skullduggery. Hauer and Schönberg were well aware of each other. Indeed, they had met and even planned to write a book together on 12-tone composition. Maybe because of their different personalities, the book never materialized. They had as much to distinguish them from each other as they had in common, both musically and personally. Schönberg had his mystical side, but Hauer seemingly much more so. Schönberg thought that Hauer was too preoccupied with his method rather than the actual results. As he wrote, "What is important in composition isn't how something is composed, but what is composed. My works are 12-tone compositions rather than 12-tone compositions." It is not so clear when you can't see the actual sentence in writing, but here Schönberg clearly wants to emphasize that what matters are the compositions per se, and that the 12-tone method is merely a means to an end rather than the end in itself. And he continues, "In this, one confuses me again with Hauer, for whom the actual composition is less important." We have just listened to the opening of Hauer's Nachklangstudien, usually translated in English as resonance studies, but for obvious reasons, here we would much prefer to translate them as echo studies. Echo can be used in German, but I much prefer the word Nachklang, not only for its sound, but also because it is a perfect example of that wonderfully literal way German has of constructing nouns, as Nachklang literally means after sound, which is exactly what an echo is. From after sounds to after thoughts, it is sad and strange to think that the moon is now 6 feet further away from Earth than it was when I was born, and it continues to distance itself from us, maybe a celestial comment on our collective conduct. So ubiquitous has its presence been through all the vicissitudes of my life that its cherished place in the night sky seems a given. For my lifetime, that is true, but not eternally so. However, for anyone worried about our favorite satellite eventually disappearing completely from view, and leaving our planet parked without the necessary gravitational pull to rotate on its axis, have no fear. Long before that celestial phenomenon becomes a reality, the sun will enter its rather cantankerous retirement and give us all, moon included, a good roasting. Kuuttamo, Moonlight, by Finnish composer Are Merikanto, played by his compatriot Liisa Pohjola. From the northern sky, let's go to the Italian Renaissance as reimagined in the imagination of a 20th century Venetian. That's from the first string quartet by Gian Francesco Malipiero, and its 20 sections were first performed in public in New England on the 25th of September 1920. It's a piece that magically encapsulates his mosaic-like composing of this period, so deliberately different from typically perceived Germanic writing, with its traditional emphasis on development and thematic unity. This work, by contrast, is like a presentation of 20 different unrealized possibilities, 20 roads glimpsed but not taken, a corridor of 20 open doors passed by without entering. Being areas where the French and Germanic worlds literally rub up against and flow into each other, the lands on either side of the Rhine have been contested by various polities for centuries. Indeed, who controlled Alsace and Lorraine was one of the biggest issues of contention and reasons to fight in the First World War. As such, we shouldn't be surprised that one of the most evocative and powerful works to come out of the carnage was composed by a man who identified as an Alsatian and a Frenchman. A piece called The Enemy Attack from the piano quintet of Charles Koechlin. After the attack comes La Blessure, the wound. An exact peer of Kurt Weill was the Viennese-born Ernst Krenek. Weill suffered a heart attack and died when he was only 50, but Krenek lived into his 90s, and from the prodigious extent of his work list, it seems like he didn't waste a moment of the life he had been obliged to live. In 1921 alone, he composed his first symphony, and his first two string quartets. Arguably even more precocious than either viol or krennic was our last young blade for today, Erich Wolfgang Korngold. He based his enormously successful opera of 1920, Die Tote Stadt, on the story Bruges la Mort, but he could just as well have written it for his own Vienna. One of the most momentous outcomes of the First World War and the various treaties that followed the armistice was the disappearance of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Whilst the Habsburgs had reigned, Vienna had been the capital of a vast European, multi-ethnic, multilingual, multicultural empire. With the empire's elimination, Vienna became a provincial capital of a small Alpine Republic, which had lost most of its agricultural land to Hungary, its great port of Trieste to Italy, and its industrial zone to the new Czechoslovakia. It became the home of thousands of imperial civil servants, with no empire and vastly fewer citizens to service. Due to these traumatic events, many of its cultural luminaries upped sticks and moved to Germany, Berlin especially benefiting from the exodus of people like Billy Wilder, Fritz Lang, Max Reinhardt, Lotte Lenya, and Arnold Schoenberg. Many aspects of the old world, not least the Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires, died with the millions of soldiers in the First World War, but it cast a large shadow, and for good or ill, it lived on in the hearts and minds of those still living. That's all we have for today, so I hope, as always, that you enjoyed the program. And don't forget, if you didn't manage to catch any of the details of the music you heard, or if I didn't mention it, all the information will appear here on this page a week from today. So with that, I'll bid you all a goodbye, and again, thanks for listening. Thank you.